Did you know that depreciation is the most expensive cost of owning a brand new car? And the average vehicle loses up to 40% of its value in the first 2 years alone? At DriverSelect.com, we remove that risk by offering you the new car alternative. Our business model focuses on one thing, acquiring 1 to 3 year old low mileage vehicles just after they've taken their biggest depreciation hit and passing the savings along to you. DriverSelect.com. Get the new car feel without the new car price.
And welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres, and every week I'm alongside my co-host Fred Alvader. Fred, hi, how are you today?
I'm fantastic, Carlos. Looking forward to talking about our subject tonight, the shorter golf ball. Man, that seems to be on everybody's minds right now. A lot of people popping up, making a comment here and there. We're going to cover that in great detail later in the show. But, you know, everything's pretty well settled on the major professional golf tours. It's two more tours into their seasons last week with the LPGA Tour's race to the CME Globe and the DP World Championship deciding the race to Dubai on the European Tour. On tonight's show, the top stories are Lexi loses the CME Globe Championship on the last hole. John Rahm completed a magical season with his win in Dubai. Plus, we've got Ed Travis in, who's a golf equipment specialist, to discuss this high-tech golf ball and what are we going to do with it. So, Carlos, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
To be or not to be, to roll it or not roll it back. Let's see what will be our coverage on that. I'm sure you're going to like it. I mean, you're going to see all both sides of that coin, and there's been a lot talked about that subject lately. So we have everything that you need to know about rolling back the golf or not. Will it happen? Just stick around. You'll see what we have to say about that. But as usual, we start with the weekend backspin, where every week we recap the weekend's action on the major tours. And this weekend, there was not one, but two major tours with their tour championships, and they went down to the wire there. And we're going to tell you all about it. But the first one that we're going to talk about, Fred has it, and that's the LPGA with the CME Group Tour Championship. What happened? There was a resurgence there by Adi Ayutthaya, and something happened to Lexi. Tell us everything.
Well, you mentioned Lexi. I mean, she had everything under control, and then she didn't. She had a one-shot lead with an 18-inch putt at the last hole, but produced one of the worst whiffs ever seen in modern golf. I mean, it was ugly. She will now forever be linked in golf history with Doug Standard's miss at the 1970 Open Championship and I.K. Kim's gaffe at the 2012 Kraft Nabisco as two of the worst missed putts of all time. The CME Globe Championship was building to a wonderful crescendo, especially for Lexi. There was a great leaderboard for the final round. Four were tied at the top after three rounds. Rhea Jutanagarn, who won the race to CME Globe last year, Suzanne Pedersen, Michelle Wee, Kim Kaufman, they were all tied for the top spot with 18 holes left to play. In addition, Lexi, your girl Sungyoung Park, Stacey Lewis, and four more were just one shot back with seven more players, including defending champion Charlie Hall, within two shots of the lead. That was 18 golfers within a two-shot margin at the beginning of play on Sunday at Tiburon, just outside of Naples, Florida. Lexi seemed to be in control. They had four birdies on the front nine, got her to 13-under, holding a two-shot lead. She added two more birdies on the back and would have been in the clubhouse with a one-shot lead, but then the unthinkable happened. After a great lag putt from 30 feet on the last hole, she
Fred has a drop right now. His call, for some reason, it went down. But he was talking about, so we'll continue to talk he will continue to talk about this once we get back on the air. He gets back on the air. He was talking about a great CME Group Tour Championship where Fallon's former world number one, Arya Jutanugarn, birdied the final two holes to win the Tour Championship by a shot there at Tiburon Golf Club. The 21-year-old world number nine was one of four joint overnight leaders, and she holds successive putts from in excess of 20 feet for a 67 and a 15 under total, which, like he was saying two groups earlier, American Lexi Thompson missed a par putt at the last from 18 inches to drop to 14 under. Britain's was defending champion Charlie Hall. She finished in a share for 11th. The 21-year-old from Kettering, who won last year for her maiden LPGA title, was five shots adrift after a two-under final round of 70. Lexi, who, as you might remember, was denied a victory in the first major of the season after a TV viewer spotted that she had incorrectly replaced a marked ball, which led to a two-stroke penalty, had seemed set for her third win of the year. But the short putt gave her the only drop shot of her round of 67, but she still secured the $1 million race to the Globe season bonus prize after finishing highest of the five players who could have won the prize this week. Jutanugarn, the former Women's British Open champion, made one of only four birdies at the 18th hole in the final round to claim her seventh career title and her second of the year after Manny Live Classic in June, having won five last year. But this was an incredible comeback for Jutanugarn, who really was one of the top players until that victory there at the Manny Live in June. But after that, she went cold. So now she's attributing her change and this newfound confidence into a change, a switch of attitude that she's saying now has her really being confident back again, and definitely showed. I mean, she shot at 67, and she was 68, 71, 67, and 67 through all four rounds. The LPGA Player of the Year award was cheered for the first time by South Korean Sung Yoon Park, who was also the LPGA Rookie of the Year on a runaway, and Soyeon Ryu. Both of them were the co-LPGA Player of the Year. U.S. Women's Open Sung Yoon Park, which is a 24-year-old world number two, has matched Nancy Lopez as the only player to win Top Player and Rookie of the Year awards in the same year. So Sung Yoon Park really has the ceiling is, I mean, the heaven is really her ceiling right now. She has a lot to go on. Jessica Korda, talking about some other notable finishers, and sorry about this, it's just that I have, this was Fred's subject, but he's not back yet, so I'll continue to talk about it. Lexi Thompson and Jessica Korda finished T2nd. Yoon Ji Ji and Pernilla Lindberg finished tie for 4th. Sung Yoon Park, like I mentioned, along with Michelle Wee in a tie for 6th. Nelly Korda and I.K. Kim and King Kaufman were T8. Se-young Kim, Jenny Shin, and Charlie Hall were tied for 11. Beyond that, that rounds up the first top players. Lydia Ko, who continues to show she was really there in it after the first round with a 67, but the 71 and 72 in the next second and third rounds really pushed her out of the contention, but she really played well. She finished that first round with a hole out that looked impossible. A great shot there for Lydia Ko. She's really more and more, slowly but surely, looking at that number one, like the player that was number one in the world not too long ago. After that, I can say that Hannah Yang, Amy Yang, and Yingjo Ko were T67. Chan Chan Feng, who really is the hottest, or at least until then, was the hottest player in the world, just couldn't get it going. She was a 70 at the first round, and 73. She was too far away to contend, and she did a great job with 67 on Saturday, but could not get anything going on Sunday. 71, good for a T21, with, among others, a tied for 21 with Anna Nordqvist. Going a little lower on the list, Brooke Henderson at T25, Maria Tanner, and Arias' sister, who was maybe expected by a lot of people because of how good she was playing. She was expected to be on top of the leaderboard. She finished with a T30. She was even all the time, 70, 72, 70, and a 71. Also, Soyeon Ryu was there for a T30. Christy Kerr with a T35. Min Jae Lee at T39. After that, Madeline Sachs from T41. So it was an overall a great tournament and a great finish for the race to the CME Globe. And Fred is back. We have him here. Fred, I
what happened?
A recap. I don't know. You got dropped, and I had to tell everything that happened there. I can hear you now.
Did you get anything? Did you get anything?
No.
Did you get anything on that?
No. You dropped in a. Yeah, I had to say the recap here. But go ahead, say any thoughts. I already went through the whole recap.
If you covered it, just the fact that just that Lexi's going to be forever linked with Doug Sanders' miss at the 1970 Open Championship and I.K. Kim's gaffe at the 2012 Kraft Nabisco as two of the worst missed putts of all time. That thing was really ugly, that 18-inch putt she missed. And, you know, the year that could have been for Lexi, I mean, if she'd have won the ANA this year instead of having that four-shot penalty for the miss mark, if she'd end up winning the CME Globe Championship, she would have won the money title, she would have won Player of the Year, she would have gone to number one, and all of that. The only thing she ended up with was the million bucks.
The Vera Trophy.
Yeah, the Vera Trophy, yeah. Yeah, that's it. So, the year that could have been, and, you know, it just kind of all fell away from her. So she made a great lag putt down there, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm sitting there watching this. I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, I hope, you know, there's no way she could miss this, right? I mean, the lag putt was perfect. You know, she left it inside of 2 feet. It was great. And then she just stepped up and just absolutely gagged it. Oh, my goodness, that was awful. So, and, you know, and the tale of two cities, you know, right, because Lexi had a great year, you know, was solid all year. Aria Jutanica struggled all year and ends up, you know, winning the thing. And you know, she had fallen to, what, number nine in the world? She was number one at the end of last year but was never really comfortable with it. So, yeah, it was just the whole thing was kind of surreal, really. And it just it made me sick to watch her do that, actually. I felt so bad for her, Carlos.
No, definitely. And I was mentioning that Aria really, like you said, after her win at the Manual Life Classic in June, after having won five last year, she really dropped. She was one of the coolest players coming into this. And I said that if you were expecting a Yutanagarn to win it, it was an Aria, it was Moria. But that she's crediting to a change in her attitude now. So, hey, that's good news for her, bad news for a lot of the other players. But overall, it was a great tournament, a great season. Lex is going to be there for sure. I mean, she did drop to 14 under, but we also have to know, which is one thing that I was debating yesterday, is it doesn't mean that she was going to win it necessarily. She was going to go into a playoff with Adia,
right,
who also ended up into 15 under. So it wasn't assured that she was going to win it. The thing was that she missed that 18-inch par putt to drop to 14 under and missed out of the playoffs. So she automatically was denied of any chance. But it doesn't mean that she was going to win. I mean, the way also that Adia was playing, she birdied the final two holes. She was on a roll, and she made one of only four birdies on the 18th hole that day. So she was really playing well. So I don't know if Lexi would have won it. Great tournament for her. Great season as well. Too bad what happened there with that TV viewer who spotted that she had incorrectly replaced a marked ball at the ANA. But I really can't wait for the Bahamas tournament, the Silk Bahamas next year to see the LPGA back in action. It's always a great tour to watch. So with that being said, let's move on now to the European Tour, where the Race to Dubai finished with the DP World Tour Championship, and Spain's John Ram won it by a single shot, while a late stumble by Justin Rose allowed Tommy Fleetwood to secure the Race to Dubai title. Ram fired closing round of 67 in the DP World Tour Championship at Jumeirah States to set a clubhouse total of 19 under par. That was good enough to earn him a second Rolex Series event title. He also won the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open earlier this year. Midway through four rounds, Justin Rose looked likely to claim the DP World Tour Championship title, and with Tommy Fleetwood struggling, the Race to Dubai crown seemed his too. But he held a one-stroke lead after an excellent front line of 32 and appeared to be cruising, but things started to go awry in the run for home. He dropped a shot at the 12th and then another at the 14th, finding the water. When Ram got up and down for a birdie at the 14th, the Spaniard took a share of the lead and moved clear when Justin dropped a stroke on the same hole. If you thought it was painful to see Lexi missing that, it was painful to see how Justin was just, imploding there. Ram made another birdie at the 16th when Rose dropped a shot there. Justin's chance of winning the tournament was effectively gone at that time. Dylan Fratelli of South Africa had an opportunity to catch Ram at 19 under, but needed an eagle at the home hole to do so. When his tee shot found the water, then Ram was all but confirmed as champion. Rose was left needing also an eagle in the home hole to claim the Race to Dubai title, but after driving into the rough, he was unable to make one. Tommy Fleetwood ended the year as the European Tour number one. Kitadesh Afibarnrat and Shane Lowry, who had a magical final round, finished the week in a tie for second place, one shot behind him. And as I said, Shane Lowry had the lowest round of the tournament at 63. That included 9 birdies and no drop shots. Sergio Garcia, he needed a lot of help and a good final round. He did close with a 65 to move up into a tie for fourth with Justin and South African Steve Burmester and Dylan Fratelli. Tyler Hatton finished tied for eighth with American Julian Suri, who started this year on the Challenge Tour, where he won the D+D Real Check Challenge in late May. But thanks to his victory in the Made in Denmark in late August, he earned his card on the bigger tour and made it here to the Tour Championship. So look out for Julian Suri. He's really playing good. Two other Americans, Patrick Reed and Peter Uihlein, finished tied for 10th. Uihlein finished 18th in the Race to Dubai in what has been his best year so far. Reed finished 30th, while the other Americans, Julian Suri, who I just mentioned, finished 52nd. Other notable finishers, Matthew Fitzpatrick in a solo 12th. Rafa Cabrera Bello was tied for 21st with Fleetwood. Brandon Grace and Ian Poulter, T31. Alex Noren and Bernd Wiesberger, T45. Lee Westwood, T52. And Thomas Peters on a tie for 58th place. It's been an amazing first year on the European Tour for Spain's run John Ram. Earlier in the week, he was presented with the Sir Henry Cotton as the Rookie of the Year award, something he should have won on the PGA Tour as well, but I'll leave it there. Otherwise, I'll take the whole section on that one. So now he has a second European Tour title to his name. Ram moved to third in the final Race to Dubai standings, just behind Fleetwood and Justin Rose. Closing with a 74 and finishing with 2 bogeys, Tommy Fleetwood would have feared he hadn't done enough to hold up Rose in the 2017 Race to Dubai. But, like I mentioned, Rose's back 9 struggles meant that Fleetwood had done just enough to secure the title and the top share of the bonus pool that goes along with that. At the end of a long season, Justin Rose was just one shot shy of claiming the Race to Dubai title. On the final Race to Dubai rankings, Fred, 2 nations took the top 7 places, England and Spain. Fleetwood and Rose were followed by Ram and Garcia, with Tyrrell Hatton from England and Russ Fischer, also from England, 5th and 6th, and Rafa Cabrera Bello from Spain was 7th.
Yeah, that's the Rolex series we talked about this year really made a big difference in getting some of the bigger names over there to play in some of those tournaments. But it has made a division between the kind of the haves and the have-nots over there. But, you know, this caps off their year with a DP World Championship. Tommy Fleetwood ends up winning the whole thing. Good for him. He kind of didn't really play that great down the stretch, but did enough to keep it in there. Hey, Carlos, the PGA Tour was in on St. Simon's Island for the RSM Classic. Davis Love's little shindig there. Austin Cook's grandfather played on the PGA Tour in the 60s, and his highlight tour moment was being paired with a 25-year-old Jack Nicklaus when he won the 1965 Memphis Open. But Austin did what his grandpa was never able to do. He won a PGA Tour event. Cook had held the 54-hole lead and fired a final round 67 to beat out runner-up J.J. Spahn. Spahn's been popping up on leaderboards all fall, so maybe he's going to break through here after the first year. Brian Gay was solo third with Brian Harman, Kevin Kisner, Chris Kirk, and Andrew Landry tying for fourth. Zach Johnson, a notable name, was T8, trying to get into form for 2018 after returning from another injury. Brant Snedeker collected T29. An amateur, Braden Thornberry, we talked about him last week, was made the cut, finished T61. He would beat out Bubba, who was a solo 67. Ernie Els missed another cut, along with tournament host Davis Love and his son Drew. Luke Donald made headlines early in the week. He had to withdraw before the tournament started. Mark Wilson took his place. Luke, who's 39 years old, posted a photo of himself on Twitter that said, thanks to the medical staff at the hospital, he was having chest pains and decided he better go get it checked out. So he ended up in the hospital. He said, that wasn't quite the finish to my year. I had in mind, had some chest pain last night and into this morning, kept getting worse. After some medical advice, I had to withdraw and was shipped off to the hospital to get my heart looked at. After 7 hours of tests, all looks good with my heart, thankfully. Probably shouldn't have had that Mexican for lunch. Carlos, Austin Cook was not one of the longest hitters in college. He attended the University of Arkansas, but he was always very consistent and a solid ball striker. Plus, he graduated with a 3.9 acume. Maybe it helps to be smart to play on the PGA Tour, Carlos, you suppose?
Yeah, you know, it helps when you start calculating angles and get all those things into it. I don't know, I'm just assuming. But no, he really has flash skills ever since, but he has clearly matured mentally, something that he has touched on all week. So that was definitely a lot of good golf played this week by him. He just made just two bogeys on the week and only missed four fairways over the 72 holes. Like I mentioned, he always had talent. In 2015, he had three top 11 finishes despite not having any status on the PGA Tour. So great to see him. He joins Mackenzie Hughes as back-to-back first-time PGA Tour winners of this event. As you might remember, Mack Hughes won last year at age 25 after 9 starts, world ranking of 287 as a rookie, and Austin Cook, 26 years old after 14 starts and ranked in the world 302. He, after graduating from the Web.com Tour, just like Hughes did last year, he's playing on his first PGA Tour for the first time with his official card and already a winner. Now, Fred, we're going to do something different. We're going to change now and switch to the practice range because our guest is here. So pretty soon we'll tell you about him, but let's start now the switch to the practice range where we're going to talk. Like every week, Fred and I pick a topic, and each of us take our own shots at it. And this week, we're going to talk about, like I said, to be or not to be, to roll or not roll back the golf ball. So let's start with the intro. Jack Nicklaus has been touting shortening the golf ball for years. Every player, he has joined the chorus, and most recently, Tiger Woods implored the USGA to take action. Three-time major champion and former world number one golfer, Nick Price has accepted a seat at the USGA's executive committee and may now be in a position to influence the USGA to accept the shorter ball. Even a major golf ball manufacturer, Bridgestone, His CEO, Angel Ilagin, recently said in an interview with Golf.com that the time has come to accept a standardized golf ball for pros. Joining us to discuss the shorter golf ball issue is Ed Travitz, who is a longtime golf writer as well as serious golfer who has a different take on the idea of changing the golf ball or bifurcation of golf equipment. Ed, welcome to the show. Thanks for giving us of your time to be with us to discuss this. How are you today? Hello, Ed.
Did we lose him?
Hello.
Oh, there he is.
There I am. Thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to be here.
You know, Ed, yeah, I'm sorry, I'll jump in here. You know, Ed, the shorter golf ball, longer golf ball, whatever, I know you've written a couple articles recently for the Ohio Golf Journal that we've published. You know, you wrote one kind of refuting Gary Player when he was jumping around saying you got to do something after the guys tore apart St. Andrews and the Dunhill links. Also, you talked about Tiger, you answered Tiger when he was saying it's got to be shorter. You don't really believe the ball needs to be shorter.
Well, no, because I don't believe there's a problem in the distance that the elite players, the real good amateurs and the guys on the pro tours are hitting the ball. I just don't see that as a problem.
One of the things that keeps coming up is that they have to build these golf courses bigger and bigger. That is not an issue for you?
Well, there's two parts to this. First of all, they're usually referring to the traditional, or as they call them, the fine old golf courses. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't do a lot of my golf at Pine Valley or other courses of that ilk, you know, Brookline and courses that would be in that category. And most of them have accommodated the longer ball for amateur events very well. But the second part about this is that this is driven by developers thinking that they have to have, now this is in quotation marks, a championship golf course. Well, that's not only, they think that's going to help them sell hotel rooms. They think it's going to help them sell residential real estate. And what it's going to do is just drive up the cost of doing business, as well as maintenance and the greens fees for the golfers coming into play. And it's just a vicious cycle that nobody wins and is unnecessary.
Hey, Ed, in what's increasingly smelling, sounding, and feeling like a build-up to a serious product-driven discussion about how to deal with the distance chase, the Wall Street Journal's Brian Kostak talks to several about where we are headed. The Saturday Wall Street Journal piece is titled "Will Golf Weights Big Shift to Reduce Distance Golf Balls?" and says golf's governing bodies are discussing different balls for different levels of the game. This is similar to something the USGA's Mike Davis floated in March and that now Costa reports. And I'm going to quote Mike Davis here. He says, "I don't care how far Tiger Woods hits it. The reality is this is affecting all golfers and affecting them in a bad way. All it's doing is increasing the cost of the game," end of quote. For those of you more recent readers, you may not know it, but this may be the strongest comments yet from a governing body figure related to the distance explosion's impact. And as for the timing of this, the comments of Davis follows his first mention of variable distance balls, Martin Slumbers bringing up the distance movements at the Open, Tiger's pointed comments to Coach Chino and Bridgestone CEO endorsing the tournament ball. So I ask you, given that we are starting to see so much on it, do you think something is going to happen now that we see those big endorsements?
I think if Jack Nicklaus, Hale Irwin, Gary Player, Tiger Woods, the CEO of Bridgestone, the executive director of the USGA, Mike Davis, continue to talk about this, it creates a lot of pressure in the media because they're reporting it from the standpoint like what they say is true. If it creates a problem, what for the average golfer, which is what Mike Davis said in the Wall Street Journal article, what's the problem? I mean, I would consider myself an average golfer. I don't hit the ball too far. My handicap hasn't plummeted since Titanium Driver came out and Titleist brought out the Pro V1. It's a difficult game, and if you can get some help with your equipment to make you enjoy the game a little bit more, that's great. If you're an elite player, a professional, or the top among the top amateurs in the country, different story. But why would they all of a sudden want to play with one golf ball when Rory McIlroy, who's the longest driver on the PGA Tour this past year, may want a very high spin ball for whatever reason. Patrick Cantlay, who's one of the new winners, and also hits the ball fairly good distance. He averages just under 300 yards, whereas McIlroy averages 317 yards. But Patrick Cantlay may need an entirely different ball for his golf swing. So is Bridgestone going to be the one who's chosen to make the standard golf ball, or is it going to be Bridgestone, Titleist, TaylorMade, et cetera, et cetera? And how would we ever get them all to be the same? I don't know of any way to do it. I'm certainly not a golf ball manufacturing expert. But this whole thing comes around to because the people who are espousing this, and particularly most recently Mike Davis, they're not giving reasons. They're giving this nebulous stuff. Well, an 8,000-yard course is what Tiger said is coming, and it's going to be really complicated, and da-da-da-da-da. It's just fuzzy thinking.
You know, one of the points you made, Ed, in the articles is that, you know, throughout history, and I always like to go back and think, well, what situation does this compare to in history? And, you know, we've seen this, but we haven't seen it, but it's happened before where, you know, in golf they went from the feathery to the gutta percha, and it was so much better, and I'm sure people said, oh, my goodness, they're ruining golf with this. And then we went to rubber and then Balata and Surlyn, and we've seen all the differences that has made. But nobody's really ever really said, oh, we need to roll it back. But now all of a sudden – you know, how would that affect ball manufacturers if we're playing one ball on tour and everybody else is trying to play something else?
Well, I think it would be terrible. All the manufacturers rely on what's called tour validation. In other words, because Dustin Johnson is playing a TaylorMade TP5 golf ball, that in some way speaks to the fact that Ed Travis ought to be playing the same ball because he, of course, wants to hit the ball the same distance DJ does.
Because you're just like Dustin Johnson.
Yeah, right. I'm 5'10". He's 6'4". He's 32 years old, I think, and I'm old enough to be his grandfather. So, I mean, it's craziness, but that's what the manufacturer's marketing plans are built around. It is not by my choice, it is not by your choice, and it frankly is not even by the choice of the manufacturers. This has been going on, forever. I look at ads that for Bobby Jones golf clubs back in the 30s. You look at the ads for Tommy Armour golf clubs back in the 40s and 50s. Wilson Staff, of course, was a prominent brand back then. I'm also old enough to remember when Spalding brought out the first Surlyn cover ball, and I can remember hitting it and thinking to myself, my Lord, is this something? Of course, I couldn't keep it on the planet, and I couldn't chip it worth a darn because if you'll remember Top Rocks, it was harder than heck. So the technology is always pushing into the game because manufacturers are trying to build within the rules of golf the most efficient and most helpful and most forgiving clubs that they can for the average golfer. It's that simple.
Carlos, you have another question?
Fred, I think you were going to talk about something on the senior tour players,
well,
clubhead speeds and stats. And
I kind of skipped over that because we got to talk about something else. But the senior tour guys, if there was a chart out that showed that, you know, they had picked up, you know, their clubhead speeds are so much better. And I was going to talk about physical fitness. Guys are so much more physically fit today, and then the equipment, the clubs also are helping with loft and launch angle and spin rate. So the guys are getting a little bit more distance from that. It's just not all the ball, isn't that right?
That's very true. As a matter of fact, as I pointed out in one of the articles you referenced, the fairways at PGA Tour stops, presuming that the weather allows them to get them into the shape that they're heading for, have stimped about the same speed as the greens I was playing back in the 50s and 60s. Now think about that. You got a guy who can hit the ball at 16 degrees launch angle with 2,500 RPM spin. It's got a club head speed of 115 miles an hour. It's going to carry 300 yards, give or take, and then the fairway is going to let it roll out another 50 yards. I don't think that's a problem with the ball and the club. I think it's a question of what you want to do from an agronomic standpoint. Add to that the fact you've got a lot more guys who are super fit, started with Tiger and his workout regimen, and you come up with the fact that it's not just the club and or the ball. I had an interesting discussion the other day with a friend of mine. He was showing me numbers about how far the guys were hitting it back in 2007 on the PGA Tour, and the average yardage was 288 yards. This last year it was 295.2. So it's gone up 7 yards in 10 years. I don't consider that to be a huge problem. I consider it a problem that the USGA didn't take care of clubs that had rebound in the faces. They had a rule going back to 1984 that said you can't have any rebound at all. And then all of a sudden they found out that there were guys making clubs that had rebound. And this was a year, well, maybe 4 years after the Ping lawsuit over the grooves, and they just walked away from the problem. In 2000, when the Pro V1 came out and became, you know, it was a solid core, low spin, high launch ball, and they walked away from that problem. So having Mike Davis is a little bit of a problem on my side, hearing Mike Davis say that it's a problem because to a large degree they caused it. That's maybe a harsh statement as far as Mr. Davis is concerned. But those are the facts.
Yeah, I have a problem. I'm a little bit like you. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Carlos.
Go ahead. Finish that statement, and then I'll talk about what I was going to say.
I was just going to say I'm kind of like you, Ed. This is a multifaceted problem, and Carlos and I have talked about it at different times, and it's just not the ball alone. We just have – I don't see it, on an everyday basis when I'm out here playing. I'm not hitting it 20 yards farther than I ever have, for goodness sake. So if the ball was all that great, my swing is – you know, I'm older, so it's not as fast as it used to be. But I'm still losing yardage. It's not going as far as it used to. So it's not – you know, it's not all the ball. It's physical shape. It's – like you say, how the courses are set up. You get a hard track like Chambers Bay was, or like Aaron Hills, where they could get some run, and you know they get that 40 yards of run off that thing because they're hitting the right launch angle. It's landing and running. We're not hitting at 350 like those guys do. The average golfer, you know, if you look at the average golf stats, they're not any ways near that. I mean, 230 yards is a great drive for an average golfer. You know, 100, 120 yards less. So it's not the ball. When is somebody going to – Wally Uline today kind of made some statements here He said the only people that seem to be grappling with advances in technology and physical fitness are the short-sighted golf course developers and the supporting golf course architectural community who built too many golf courses where the notion of championship golf course was exactly what you were talking about earlier. The people would say, well, it's higher maintenance for the golf courses because they got more ground to take care of. Well, is there any evidence to support that? Where does that come from? But then the coolest thing was he takes a shot at Bridgestone because the Bridgestone guy, as Carlos said earlier, came out in support of the shorter ball. Given Bridgestone's very small worldwide market share and paltry presence in the professional golf, it would seem logical they would have a commercial motive making the case for a reduced distance golf ball. So Wally kind of weighed in. He said, you guys are all crazy. Get off this shorter ball topic. Jeff Ogilvie made some comments in Australia also yesterday that he said maybe he's for a shorter ball. He thinks that the ball is caused to – it's like baseball, where baseball and the major leagues use a wooden bat rather than aluminum because if they use aluminum, they'd outgrow the stadiums. He said, well, maybe we've outgrown the stadiums. So I don't have the answer, but, Ed, I really don't think – that shorting the golf ball is the right answer at this point in time. I think it's a knee jerk. I think it's kind of like the snowball rolling downhill. Everybody's kind of jumping onto it.
I think you're exactly right, and I think it's an evolutionary thing. But one other comment that might be worth throwing into the mix is if the USGA thought they had a problem with Carsten Solheim suing them for the change in the groove rule and with a potential of triple losses of $300 million if they found that it was an anti-competitive lawsuit, if they lost, do you think that the ball manufacturers today are going to sit still while the USGA says, well, by the way, we don't want people to hit the ball as far? I don't think they would. I think that there would be another lawsuit that would make the Ping lawsuit look like patty cake between kindergartners.
And do you think, just taking the other side of this, because, I mean, even though, like, Wally Uline is saying that there is no evidence on this, but it makes sense what it's being said. I mean, if I have a longer and a bigger course, I need to have more maintenance on it. And as well, there's other factors that, like Fred is saying, yes, I understand that the ball is not the only factor, but it has to be factoring somehow. But let's go to a question. Let's go to this hypothetical situation. Imagine that the USGA and the RNA say that it's enough is enough, and they determine that the golf ball is going too far and making some of the golf courses obsolete at the top level of the game, okay? And then they make an announcement that the golf balls played on tour will be rolled back by 10%, so the drive that used to go 300 will go now 270 yards in theory and so on. And they announce that this rule will apply to all professional tournaments as well as high-level amateur tournaments like the U.S. Amateur, the British Amateur. And after that decision, the OEMs decide that they're going to sell a version of their tour ball that fits the rollback and also sell a version of the unrestricted ball that is not rolled back. But it still has that features of a premium ball like multi-layer construction and urethane cover. So what do you do as a player, as the average golf player? Do you decide to play the tour ball because that's what the pros play, or the unrestricted ball because you don't want to give up any distance? That's a pretty clear example of bifurcation of the rules of golf. So I'm interested in both of your thoughts on that.
Well,
go ahead, Ed.
Like all hypothetical situations, there's a number of circumstances that affect it. But on the basis that Carlos described it, I don't think anybody in their right mind would be playing the same ball then that the guys on the PGA Tour were forced to play. I think all the guys that I play with, all the guys that I know of, aren't going to give up 10% yardage. I mean, heck, in my case, that might almost be 15, 20 yards. You can't 12. So I guess that it would be a simple case of Hank Haney said something really interesting. He said, you know, golf is about, professional golf is about the fans. It's not about the players. Okay, we forget that sometimes. It's about the fans because they're the ones footing the bill. And the fans go to the golf course not to hope, and they don't go there hoping that they're going to see a bunch of good bunt singles. They're going to go there and they're looking for the long ball. They want to see Rory and Bubba and DJ. They want to see the 300-yard. And if you look at the scoring on the PGA Tour, the driving distance on the PGA Tour has absolutely no correlation with the money list. Scoring has a pretty good correlation. To put it another way, the guy who wins the most money, the most last year, of course, was Justin Thomas, had a phenomenal year. He hits the ball just over 300 yards. He's number eight in driving distance, but he's number three in scoring. Jordan Spieth, I think we've all heard of. He was the second on the money list. He was number one in scoring. He was 75th in driving distance. I think that's a pretty strong case. If you look at the top 20 guys on the money list from last year, rather than looking at it sorted by how far they hit the ball, look at it in the way that they earn their money. And it's pretty obvious that a bifurcation of the ball is just silliness. Because it's going to affect Jordan Spieth a hell of a lot differently than it does Rory McIlroy. And I don't think that's fair. I think that's pretty discriminatory.
From the average golfer's standpoint, you know that commercial on television where the guy, there's the guy that likes to keep banging his head on the beam in the attic, and there's the guy that likes to have his arm stuck up in the vending machine. Let me have the shorter golf ball because I want to keep hitting my 3-wood and hitting 9-irons and 7-irons into par for my third shot into par 4 greens. Yeah, I want more of that. So, yeah, and the whole problem, I mean, one of the whole big things of golf is just exactly what Ed said earlier is tour validation. And it's the fact that the average golfer wants to go play at the courses with the same equipment that the pros play and see how they test their game, how their game compares to what the pros do there. Yeah, they may play from a more forward tee. They'll take that. But they're not going to want to play with a different ball. They don't want to play with a different driver. They don't want to play with a different set of irons. They want the same stuff that the pros are using, Carlos.
Okay, so now the final question for Ed and for you is, I mean, where does this end? I mean, we've seen both sides. Of course, I tend to disagree a little bit on the fact that everybody wants to see the long ball. I think that there's a lot of people also that wants to see more of the strategy. And just like in baseball, they had to do something about it. They saw all those home runs, and they had to do something. They didn't – previous people were being just bored about so many home runs. You want to see the pitchers try to get into the batter's head and try to do some strategy. So it's not all about the long ball and the longer hitters. It's more about let's – put some difficulty into the shots that you're going to get there. So where does this end? Is it going to be – how do you see this being sorted out?
I am afraid that we're going to wind up with two golf balls and maybe two specifications on golf clubs, one for professionals and elite amateurs and one for the rest of us guys. I think that would be just a horrible, terrible thing to have happen to the game. I don't think that it would in any way help the average player. It certainly would not help the golf fans. It would not help attendance at tournaments. It would not help sales of merchandise. It would not help corporate sponsor sales, which is a big deal in terms of how much money the tour is able to generate the tournaments. It would not help equipment sales. I can't think of one possible way that it would help except for one, and that is that it would be the guys who are sitting around wringing their hands now about the ball's going too far, not looking at creative solutions for, like, not having, if you've got a, God forbid, an 8,000-yard course, I can't imagine anybody would, but having, let's say, a longer course than they presently have, using natural areas in between the holes where it's maybe just dead area, or using different kinds of grasses or any one of the other number of creative solutions that the golf course superintendents have come up with. Rather than being wall-to-wall green, use less water. Rather than having, in Florida here where I live, rather than overseeding in the wintertime, which takes lots of time, lots of money, lots of chemicals, let it go brown. Overseed your greens, overseed your tees, and have a, that kind of a thing. Those types of things aren't being entered into the discussion. Therefore, I believe that ultimately we run a great, great, very strong possibility that Mike Davis is going to get his way and the golf ball's going to be rolled back. And I hope I'm not around to have to deal with that.
Your thoughts, Fred?
Yeah. Yeah, I see the wagons are circling. There's too many people talking about this and people that throw some weight around in the golf community. You know, we mentioned the names earlier, Tiger and Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus and Mike Davis. And these guys, I mean, they have some serious weight. So when they talk, people tend to listen. And even the casual golf fan doesn't know any better. Those guys hit it too far. I can't. That's 150 yards more than me. Maybe they should not be able to hit it that far, you know. Well, you know, you got to look at all this stuff. And people have been around the game for a long, long time. You know, we've seen different stuff come and go. And maybe this isn't the worst thing in the world that's happening. Maybe we ought to just step back here a second and think this thing through. So That's really why I wanted to do this discussion tonight, because I knew Ed had these points, and I wanted to make sure that they got out here and people heard them.
There you have it. That was our take on to roll it or not roll it back, the golf ball. I hope you enjoyed. Ed, thank you for your great knowledge, your great insight here. It's always appreciated.
Well, thanks for having me, Carlos. It was a pleasure, and anytime. Glad to come back anytime.
Thank you. Hope we can get you soon, and we'll see when we get more information on this. We hope to bring you back, and then we'll discuss what's going on with the rollback or not rolling back. Fred, any final words for Ed and before we close the segment?
Nope, that was great. Thanks, Ed. Talk to you later, buddy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy holidays and happy Thanksgiving, Ed. Have a good one.
Thank you very much. Same to you.
There you have it. That was Ed Travis, a longtime golf writer as well as a serious golfer who writes and has his take on the idea of changing the golf ball or bifurcation of the golf equipment. And what's our VIG on the practice range to roll the golf back or not roll it back? Fred, let's take back where we caught last time where we were on the show and we were still talking about the recaps of the weekend's action, the weekend backswing. There was still one more tournament that we needed to talk about. That was the Dunlop Phoenix Open, which is always good to attract a handful of known names in the golf world to one of the crowning events on the Japan Tour. And this year, Brooks Koepka torched the Phoenix Country Club in Miyazaki to reach 20 under par for a 9-stroke victory over Thailand's Prayat Marksang, South Korean's Sang-hee Lee, and American Xander Schauffele. The 27-year-old American had an easier time than his win at the Dunlop Phoenix last year, where he had to hold off Yuta Ikeda by one. His margin of victory is the largest in the tournament's history, dating back to 1972, beating Tiger Woods' 8-stroke romp in 2004. He led wire-to-wire, and his 64 on Saturday was the low round of the week. Marksang, he began the day as Koepka's closest competitor, just 4 back, but the Thai, ranked number 281 in the world, spotted for a closing one over 72, the highest round of anyone in the top 10. Koepka is among the likes of Woods, Johnny Miller, Seve Ballesteros, Tom Watson, David Duval, and Ernie Els, who have won the Dunlop Phoenix Open. Gallery favorite Hideki Matsuyama, he began the day 7 strokes back of Koepka, but showed promise when he made an ace on the number 3. The momentum was short-lived as Matsuyama's 2-under-69 wasn't enough to even gain ground on Koepka's 67. This is the second time that Matsuyama has finished runner-up to Koepka, the other coming at this year's U.S. Open. And he said of him in a post by the Japan Times, and I quote, "I feel there's a huge gap between us," end of quote. Matsuyama seemed worried about his game, though we all know he's his harshest critic. He just needs to get his focus back. Last year was one of ups and downs, and being a father for the first time seems to have really taken a toll on him and his focus away from the course. Fred with a top 5 against a decent field this past week and a T5 at the CIMB Classic last month. I think he's climbing back up. And it's far too soon to hit the panic button on Matsuyama, who won the 2014 Double Up edition. And I think next year he should be back to where he was climbing up.
Yeah, well, we've seen Brooks just keep getting better and better, more confident. Hanging out with Dustin Johnson helps him in a lot of ways. And, yeah, Hideki, just had to took off like a streak last year and kind of faded down the stretch here over the summer. But still very good player, and evidently just some off-course things got his attention away from golf. And, you know, he just wasn't concentrating quite like he was. We talk about that from time to time, off-course stuff. Life happens. So, and it carries over on the golf course, and you just don't concentrate quite as well. So you don't find his golf maybe as important as it once was for whatever reason. So I'm sure he'll do fine, Carlos. Brooks, back-to-back, wins by 9 shots, kind of showed the guys how to get it done, huh?
And with that, we wrap up the weekend backswing. Now let's talk about the four-call or the weekend's preview, quick preview. And this week, we're going to talk only about one tournament because, like you saw, the LPGA, the European Tour, all the tours are gone for now. The PGA Tour is having what they call the wraparound season. So, but they even are off until next year. The Hero World Challenge will be next week, so we'll be previewing next Tuesday. So let's talk about the PGA of Australia, the Emirates Australian Open. The PGA Tour of Australia is down to the final two events in its schedule, which are the two most important on the tour, the Emirates Australian Open and the Australian PGA Championship. But we'll talk about the one this week, which is the Emirates Australian Open, owned and run by the Golf Australia, which is the oldest and most prestigious golf tournament on the PGA Tour of Australasia. The Open was first played in 1904 and takes place toward the end of each year. The winner of the tournament receives the Stonehaven Cup. The prize money, which is $1.25 million, is considered modest when compared to tournaments on the PGA Tour and the European Tour. However, the Australians' Open position is one of the traditional golf powers. Winners between the mid-1950s to the late 1980s included many of the most distinguished international golfers like Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, and Gary Player. The Australian Open is the flagship tournament of the PGA Tour of Australasia. Having a special status on the official World Golf Ranking point system, the status awards a minimum of 32 points to the winner, regardless of the strength of the field. The tournament is also part of the One Asia Tour, which was formed in 2009. And since the Open qualifying series was introduced for the 2014 Open Championship, the Australian Open has been one of the qualifying tournaments, giving up to 3 non-exempt players entry into the Open Championship. It's really the first one to begin giving points and entry there. In recent years, American Jordan Spieth has dominated the event, winning twice in 2014 and 2016, and finishing runner-up once to Matt Jones in 2015, England's Lee Westwood in 1997, and Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy in 2013 are the only European golfers to have won the tournament. This year, Spieth will be back to defend his title at the Australian Golf Club Rosebery in Sydney, where he won in 2014 by 6 strokes. from the home country, Jeff Ogilvy, the 2006 U.S. Open champion, will be spearheading an array of past Australian champions to return for his national championship. He joins fellow Victorians Steve Allen and Robert Allenby, who alongside home state heroes Craig Perry and Peter Lonard and 2015 champion Matt Jones and Greg Chalmers, bring to 12 the number of titles from the home country already returning to the Australian Golf Club from the home country there. Another Australian, Cameron Smith, will be present along with his Surrey Classic winning partner, Sweden's Jonas Blix. They paired earlier in the year to win the inaugural team format edition of the Surrey Classic. Fred, not a lot of big-time names known in the U.S., and you would think that Jordan Spieth will easily win for the third time, which he totally can do, but don't discount the home players. This tournament means a lot down under, and they will just not hand it the title easy.
Yeah, I'm surprised that Jordan went back down there again to play, but good for him. And he's doing it without Michael Greller on the bag. Greller's wife, they had a baby just a couple weeks ago, and so Greller's going to stay home, spend some time at home with the family. And so Jordan's coach, Cam Cameron, is going to caddy for him this week. So taking a little buddy's trip to Australia to play a little golf and see the sights down under. So good for them, Carlos.
And
I think
that go ahead, yes.
Yep, go ahead. Yes. Yep.
No, go ahead.
That wraps
what
up.
I was gonna say.
Yep, the preview section. And we also want to mention, though, that the Ohio Golf Journal offers golfaholics a diverse collection of topics that cover every area of golf. Tips to help your game, rules, explanations, equipment review, travel to the best golf resorts, history and opinion on current golf issues are covered every month. Ohio Golf Journal has some of the best golf writers that provide their knowledge on the game of golf, and you heard one of them tonight. Ed does a great job providing information. In the November issue, we talk about how the Amateur Golf Alliance is helping amateur golfers, the things we're thankful for as golfaholics, and we feature golf travel opportunities to Bryan Park in Greensboro, North Carolina, and Reynolds Lake Oconee on the Georgia-South Carolina line. Visit OhioGolfJournal.com, click on the cover, and read the whole magazine, or click on any article that catches your eye. Don't forget to watch Back Nine Report TV on Roku for a different take on the golf news. There'll be a new video up on Roku. Should be tomorrow or the next day, Carlos, by the way. So don't miss that.
And with that, we wrap up the four call or the quick previews. Now we go to the par five news, which we're going to have a par six today. And Fred, you're going to tee it off with a news that we had about the subject that we talked about last week on the practice range, which is the gender bias and sexual harassment, and it has touched golf. So tell us about it.
Yeah, the two biggest issues right now going around in media is the rollback, the shorter golf ball that we were talking about earlier in the show, and then sexual harassment outside of golf. You know, Hollywood, the Weinstein thing started it, and now it's into politics. It's all over the place, and it's now affecting golf. Last week, it was revealed that a female employee of the Abandoned Dunes sued the resort's general manager for sexual harassment. Kipper Sports, who manages the resort, was also named in the suit, alleging sexual assault, harassment, discrimination, retaliation, and negligence. Court documents show the allegations aren't just limited to the golf club in Abandoned. Two employees claim the alleged misconduct has been pervasive for years at the corporate office. Top executives are accused by the lawsuit of not only condoning the behavior, but also participating in sexually inappropriate conduct themselves. The documents reveal an alleged boys' club, which is described as a place where women could only advance if they accepted a sexually hostile work environment that included regular harassment, inappropriate touching, and or, for at least one female executive, a threat of rape. The female employee, Darla Hamblin, was Bandon Dunes' director of reservation services. She is suing her former manager, Henrik Hank Hickok, and Bannon Dunes parent company, Kemper Sports, for $500,000 for emotional stress, humiliation, damages, and medical expenses. A former female executive of the Chicago corporate office submitted a declaration in support of Hamblin and alleged allegations of sexual harassment from the company's top executive staff. A trial date was set for last week, but the case was settled out of court. A lawyer for Hamblin said the matter had been amicably resolved. So evidently somebody wrote a big check. Hamblin had claimed that the general manager, Henrik Hank Hickok, made several unwanted and embarrassing comments to her over the years. These became worse after his wife was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2015 and his drinking increased. Hamblin did not want to lose her job, but the comments and abuse continued to escalate, with Hickok even trying to forcibly kiss her after an office party. The article goes into great detail of the abuse and can be read in its entirety on the KGW.com website, a Portland, Oregon TV station. So, Carlos, we just talked about gender bias last week, and now we've got sexual harassment in the golf industry. Where does it all end?
I don't see an end, and that's what we talked about. I mean, I understand there are going to be some serious claims and some that are going to be not serious, and I don't know where this is going to go, but I know that some talk has to start. We have to, just like it's happening with the golf ball, something's got to happen, and something's got to, we have to start talking about it and try to do some things about this. Sit down, let's start getting some laws, something, because also I would like to see something done for the people who are just doing it for just the heck of it, because I still believe there's going to be a lot of because there's everything out there, and I'm not talking about only the women, which is one thing I was clarifying last week. There's men also that go through this. So whatever it is, whoever it is, a man or a woman, I believe there has to be something to be taken care of. Also the ones that for any relationship, my worry is that for now, if something bad would happen in a relationship, friendship, or anything, that other person would just turn back and say, hey, you harassed me or you did this to me just to get back to you. So that has to also stop at a point. And I believe that's going to be a point for discussion maybe for the future. But if not, we'll be here again talking another section. So that's my take on that. But anyway, let's ask ourselves a question. Is Ricky Fowler serious in saying that Tiger Woods is hitting the ball way by him? The question I would say, Fred, is did he say it way by me? Or, yeah, way by me. I didn't hear it, so I don't know. But according to Ricky, Big Cat may be more than ready to return than we think. Tiger Woods has never been one to shy away from that. The 14-time major winner has always had an itch for the long ball, and he spent the first two decades of his career scratching it. Apparently, he has to itch again. Ricky Fowler was recently asked by Golf.com Dylan Dethier how Woods was looking, and Fowler said Tiger was hitting it way by him. Of course, Ricky might have also been joking, but let's presume he wasn't. Ricky ranked number 41 on the PGA Tour last year, averaging 300.3 yards off the tee. In his last 4 years on the PGA Tour, Woods ranked number 49 at 293.2 yards. So he apparently picked up a lot of distance since then, or maybe the equipment is just that much better. Could it be the ball? We'll talk about that later. I mean, we already did. Let's recap what Tiger told Gino Auriemma on his podcast recently. And I quote, "I can't believe how far I'm hitting the golf ball. I'm back to hitting it my full numbers and not really trying to do that. I didn't realize how much I had dropped off because of the pain in my back. And for me, going at it and hitting it normal, just because I just lived it from day to day, and I really couldn't tell the difference. But now I can tell the difference," end of quote. So is he hitting it past Ricky, or was Ricky joking? Who knows? Deathier clarified that the exchange might have been a bit tongue-in-cheek. Tiger is making yet another much-anticipated return to golf next week at the Hero World Challenge. Over the last couple of months, we've gotten to see a small glimpse of Tiger's progress in his return, and with every new Twitter, Instagram video, his swing looks more and more relaxed. Of course, there are doubters out there who believe Tiger will push himself too far, too fast, and screw up his body yet again. But he seems to understand that he can't go back to the swing he had in the early 2000s. No one can truly know, other than Big Cat Fred. What I do know is that we'll get a lot of questions answered at the end of this month when both of them tee it up at the Hero World Challenge in the Bahamas.
I don't know about you, Carlos, but I'm getting excited. I mean, it's like I'm building up for the Masters here. I want to see what he's going to do. I really don't expect much. I expect to see him hitting it long. I do that, but I expect to see him hitting it long left and long right, way off the fairway someplace. So, when he's come back the last couple of times, his chipping was so bad that it was just like, I mean, it was like watching a 15 handicapper trying to chip. It was ugly. And when he was at his prime, he was the best chipper and putter and short game from inside 100 yards of anybody that's ever been seen. So, it's great that he's hitting it far. I'm happy. I want to see that. But I'm really more interested in seeing what he's going to do from 150 yards in. So I don't expect a lot, but I can't wait to see him play, Carlos. I don't know about you. But, Carlos, our next story, we hear a lot about golf courses closing. Matter of fact, last year, 200 golf courses closed. There's about 14,000 golf courses in the United States. But about 200 of them closed up permanent last year. Some areas, however, are beginning to realize the importance of having accessible golf facilities for their citizens and youth. Two towns in Florida have made the decision to use public money to invest in golf properties that had been closed down or were on the chopping block. Tarmac, Florida, a small town inland from Fort Lauderdale, right on the Florida Turnpike, recently purchased the 36-hole facility Colony West to keep it from being developed as condos, residential, and strip malls. God knows the world needs more strip malls. Colony West was originally built to become the home of the old Jackie Gleason PGA Tournament, which is now the Honda Classic, but it fallen on hard times and was ready to meet the bulldozer. The town decided to buy the property for $4 million and has committed another $7.5 million to update the property and build a new clubhouse to hold local events. One of the reasons was the trend upward of the number of rounds played at Colony West over the past 2 years. 2016 saw 60,000 rounds played. It increased 10% to 66,000 in 2017. Fairfield Suites Hotel is building a new property adjoining the course, and the town will actively seek corporate meetings and conferences to the area. A little farther north in Boca Raton, the old Ocean Breeze golf course had closed its doors, and due to the energetic efforts of its local golf population, the Parks and Recreation Department's ponied up $24 million of taxpayer money to purchase the property. The new club will be called Boca National and will be home to local collegiate golf teams, Lynn University and Florida Atlantic. A new high-tech golf academy will be added and upgrades to the overall facility to maintain it as a high-end public facility. Florida has over 1,400 golf clubs and courses within the state. The golf business is very important for snowbirds that head south every winter, and with so many of the baby boomers now in retirement and looking for a place to play a little golf, these two Florida communities have responded and decided these courses need to be kept viable to keep their communities attracting new growth for a larger tax base in the future, Carlos.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes, we have seen And they said this might be another take on trying to expand on what you're saying. We've seen this consolidation in various sectors of the golf industry. And when it comes to golf courses, there are those who typically, they have to be outside the sports industry, who point to the number of closures as a barometer of the game's health. But there's a problem with that simplistic view, though. It doesn't capture the scope of what's actually happening. Particularly, what's regularly ignored by naysayers is that more than 4,000 new golf facilities were opened over a 20-year boom period from 1986 through 2006. During one stretch, there was almost one new golf course opening every day. Needless to say, that was an unsustainable trajectory. For any industry, let alone one that has the special demands of golf, if a course can't compete in an overly saturated market, that land becomes mightily appealing, whether it's for developers, multi-use parkland, or nature conservation areas. So what we've seen since 2006 is a natural correction in the course industry, which is a gradual balancing of supply and demand. Yes, more than 200 courses closed last year, but that amounted to only 1.2% decline in the total supply of U.S. courses, according to the NGF's annual facilities report. And the amount of rounds played really has actually increased slightly over the past 2 years. So golfers aren't giving up the same game when courses close. They're simply going elsewhere to play. And we will see more new great golf courses opening this year, like Stringsong Black, Sylvie's Valley Ranch, and Stoughton Bray. And like you're mentioning, there's also a lot of renovations going across the U.S. So there's a lot of investment going, which is over $3 billion, according to the National Golf Foundation, which is a significant number and one that would grow exponentially if we consider also the minor rehabilitation projects like bunker work here and there, tweaking a green, removing trees. So definitely the industry of golf is still there. It's just a natural shift that is happening in golf course projects. So right now I think we're doing what you're saying is really what we're seeing and what we will continue to see as the future moves on. So, Fred, everyone knows my steady position on speeding up play. I have been and will continue to be an avid proponent of ending the ridiculous slow play that we see, mostly on this side of the pond where I can literally get up my comfy couch, go get myself a soda, make some popcorn while a player is lining up a putt or any shot and still return before the shot is made. Trust me, I have done it. So it's interesting that buried in an article about the surprise split earlier this year between agent Chubby Chandler and Lee Westwood is an intriguing notion by Chandler on how to speed up play. The European Tour Challenge Tour will try it out in one event next year to see how it goes. Question is whether if it's a genius idea or a badass crazy one. By way of example, next year's European Challenge Tour is expected to feature an event that Chandler has a hand in, on which par will be every player's friend. In a bid to finally win the seemingly never-ending battle with slow play, every competitor will be banned for putting for par. As soon as a birdie has not been achieved, it will be ball in pocket and on to the next goal, to the next hole. Xavi says, and I quote, "It won't just be that par doesn't count. The players will be banned from putting out once they haven't made a birdie. That way they will be all round in 3 hours. We will have 2 points for a birdie, 5 for an eagle, and an 8 for an albatross. That's been done before, but not putting for par, which counts at 0. So you can knock it out of a bunker to 4 feet and putt for par. Not allowed. And that's where things will speed up." End of quote. Players will also get double points if they hole out from off the green, and all points will double on the last 3 holes. He continued saying, "Everybody's in with a chance right to the end. That might all turn out wrong, but it could also be really exciting. We will see. We're not changing the game that much. We're just making it quicker and getting rid of all the dull bits. no one really gives a bleep about eight footers for par, end of quotes. I can honestly say I'm interested in seeing how it develops. Of course, this will never happen at a major, but I agree with Xavi. I mean, there isn't a more boring aspect of golf viewing than gazing at countless golf players lining up 5 footers for par. That is where I go get things from the fridge and do my popcorn. So you would say now, Carlos, that's not true golf. Or, man, that putt could cost someone $1 million. They really have to line it up. When all things are equal to everyone, there's no advantage. If you're good, you will continue to be good when all things are equal to everyone, including the time clock to make that freaking putt. Go ahead and do it. There are times when tradition needs to take a break just to see if blasphemous epiphanies poisoning the very fabric of a sport might actually add to the playing and viewing enjoyment. Can anyone say designated hitters? I mean, for instance, in some charity events, the best formats at par or bogey as your friend keeps the pace moving and removes the horror of six-hour marathons. Will it work? Absolutely. But you will have to pick your spots. Fred, I know you will find this preposterous and maybe ridiculous, but remember, Facebook, Amazon, Google, Dell, Twitter, Tesla, Instagram, LinkedIn, PayPal, Uber, and Airbnb were considered ridiculous startup ideas, and I think they really like where they are right now. Golf needs change, and one of those is speed up play. This may seem ridiculous and blasphemous to some, but I assure you, the death of slow play is coming. This might not be the part of it, but it will continue to contribute to expanding the talk and eventual change.
This sounds more like a rant to me. So how do you really feel?
I like it. That was it.
Well done. Well done. No, I just don't see that catching on. I mean, what do you do with the guy that makes double bogey? So, you know, a real inconsistent player, they just go for birdie on every hole. I can't. I'm not into that. It will speed up play. It will definitely speed up play without question. But I can't get behind that idea, Carlos. Sorry. Hey, we got some more business news tonight in the golf media business, actually. According to a piece on Jeff Shackelford's website, the possible sale of Golf Magazine is getting done. Bids from prospective buyers were due last Friday, and there seem to be at least two legitimate parties that want to acquire the publication. Golf.com URL from Time, Inc. There is a problem because Time is in a takeover battle by Koch Brothers, and they may or not want to block the sale of Golf.com and Golf Magazine. The New York Times is reporting that the Kochs have lined up $3 billion in financing from four banks. Their minions have been busy lately trying to make sense of Time's financials, which have become somewhat complicated due to the pending sales of several magazines, including Sunset and Golf and a stake in Essence. Vanity Fair's financial reporter suggested the sales are going forward separately. Everything's going to get done. How golf and Sports Illustrated coexist going forward is one of the most interest to golfers, as is having a major source for news with several important writers on the mastheads. We're going to see some huge change. The ESPN thing was announced. They're going to lay off a bunch of big-name people. We're going to see a lot of names, familiar names of golf writers and that are just going to be out in the cold. Another business dealing of interest to golfers, Comcast, who owns NBC and the Golf Channel, is negotiating to buy certain Fox assets. I wonder if they'll end up with the U.S. Open. L.A. Times business writer Meg James says that Comcast would want film studios and sports networks from Fox. As everyone knows, Fox is paying nearly $100 million a year for the rights to the USGA championships for another 9 years through 2026. Even though the USGA likes the big check every year, Fox and USGA have not been amenable partners through the first 3 years of the deal. this obvious impact of golfers on all of us will be that you may have to switch up what broadcasting plan you choose to assure you're able to receive coverage of golf tournaments. For right now, ABC and ESPN are out of the golf game, with Fox, CBS, and NBC Golf Channel doing most of the heavy lifting. I mentioned the ESPN, who's lost over $80 million in declining cable numbers. We've talked about that before. They're going to lay off a bunch of people. So, you know, Carlos, you can keep track. You can really track the downturn of ESPN back to the beginning of Golf Channel, which led to the start of other networks beginning their own sports broadcasting and the addition of Fox into the game. Plus, now with so much sports available on the Internet, everyone's leaving cable, which accounted for the majority of the sport giants' revenue stream. It's kind of fun to follow because it affects some big-time golf writers and personalities, but all in all, it's just simply business as usual, Carlos.
Hey, Fred, as we always try to find and talk about real feel-good stories in golf, and this one is no exception. On both sides of the pond, the mention of Q School evokes a story of agony and despair. While that's the substance to most tales of tour ambitions, the narrative of Jonathan Thompson is decidedly different and might be the story of the year. Thompson, who was diagnosed with a strain of acute lymphoblastic leukemia at the age of 7 and went into remission after 5 years of extensive chemotherapy treatment, turned in a birdie-birdie finish in his final day of the taxing six-round tournament in Spain, an ending that earned his first European Tour card by a mere 2 shots. After making the turn in 32, Thompson seemed to be in a good standing, but this is Q School, where fortunes change quickly, as Thompson proceeded to bogey 3 of the first 5 holes on the back. Luckily, he righted the ship with consecutive pars before his spectacular finish. Thompson shot 67, 72, 68, 67, 71, and 69 at Q School to qualify with 2 strokes to spare. In what was a very emotional scene to watch, Thompson hugged his tearful father after shooting 269 at Lumin Golf Club in Tarragona, Spain, to become one of 33 players to get playing privilege for Europe's main tour for the 2018 season. Sam Horsfield shot a final round of 63 to win the Q School by 8 strokes on 27 under par. Having come through the first and second stages of qualifying, Horsfield played 252 holes to get his European Tour card. Two former winners of the European Tour, Gonzalo Fernandez Castaño and Anders Hansen, regained their playing privilege for the main tour as well. But it was the 21-year-old Thompson who said afterwards, "I've come through all 3 stages. I got in on the mark on the first stage, and then a playoff in the second stage, and now I am an European Tour member, so it's been a hell of a journey." Don't expect this to be the last you've heard of Thompson. Turning pro last year, Thompson spent most of this season on the EuroPro circuit, which is European golf's 3rd tier. He's all 6'9", making him one of the tallest players in golf premier ranks. His height is something he uses to his advantage off the tee, according to his friend Tyrell Hatton, who told the Associated Press, "I know who will be leading the driving distance stat next year." Fred, I know he might have heard many times the saying golf's next big thing, which he literally can be, but jokes aside, we're happy to see him after all that he has gone through earn his European Tour card, and we wish him nothing but the best of success. I will certainly be looking forward to his development next year.
Absolutely. We got to keep an eye on that guy, Carlos.
And with that, we wrap up our Par 5 news. Now, we did it already in the practice range. We're going to go straight into the final putts. And as usual, I'll start with mine. Drive Shack, a new well-financed competitor to Topgolf, is preparing to open its first location in Orlando and promises an aggressive nationwide expansion. Hold on a second. Sorry about this. Okay. New York-based DriveCheck is an offshoot of American Golf, the multi-course operator that Fortress Investment Group, LLC, acquired in 2013. American Golf was managed in recent years by Newcastle Investment Corp., which is a Fortress affiliate that used to operate as a real estate investment trust. And Newcastle announced in late 2016 that it was changing its name to DriveCheck and would not retain its right status. Sara L. Watterson, who is DriveCheck's CEO and president, said the company's decision to enter the entertainment category could be traced to the acquisition of American Golf. In December of 2016, an investor presentation, DriveCheck noted that there is a limited player growth in golf, but that consumers were attracted to social entertainment options. We have talked about some regional competitors that have emerged for top golf, like Flying T in Tulsa and Four in Lubbock, Texas. But one thing that we can certainly be reassured of, and thanks to what DriveCheck CEO said, is that they, just like all others, are after the social entertainment options, not the growth of the game of golf or the amount of golfers. And on my final pod, 3 weeks after her historic win at the Division III Central Boys Golf Tournament, Lunenburg's Emily Nash was honored by the Mid-America Intercollegiate Athletics Association, the MIAA, at its annual Sportsmanship Summit at Gillette Stadium. We talked at large about the controversy ignited last month when Emily won the sectional title by 4 strokes, but was not allowed to compete in the Division III Boys State Tournament according to the MIAA rules. The MIAA received tons of negative publicity as a result. Golfers and athletes throughout the country voiced their support for Emily, and then she accepted an offer from former pro golf great Annika Sorenstam to compete in the Annika Invitational at the World Golf Village in St. Augustine, Florida in January. MIAA Executive Director Bill Gaines said in a statement that it was a privilege to honor Nash for her outstanding sportsmanship and precedent-setting achievement. Fred, this may not be, but certainly has the look and feel of a redemption attempt to me, Fred.
Yeah, kind of a weak attempt, but at least it was something, I guess. Billy Horschel took to Twitter to take Golf Channel's Brandel Chamblee to task after Chamblee was comparing Tiger Woods' swings from now to the past. Horschel said, "Are you sure that's what Sean and Tiger were trying to accomplish? Doubt you talk to either of them about what they're working on. You're a ghost on the range." Seems like Billy is not a fan of Brandel Chamblee. I found this mildly interesting. A publication called Golf.Inc. had a list of the 30 most influential people in golf. First of all, it was all men, which kind of is a joke in itself. Although she goes about it very quietly, Annika Sorenstam wields a very big stick in the world of golf. Plus, Susie Whaley is very close to becoming the first female president of the PGA of America, and she's already been the woman behind the men pulling the strings in some of the major decisions of that body. Second, they put President Donald Trump at the top of the list. He may have been one of the most influential men in golf before he ran for president, but he's totally out of the game right now. So it's hard to take this list too seriously, but it did put into perspective some of the big names that make the decisions that shape the game we currently see, especially on TV. President, as I mentioned, Trump was number one. Dana Garmany, number two, who is the president of Troon Golf. They're a large manager company. They manage well over 200 and some golf courses around the country. Number three was Jack Nicklaus. Four was Mike Kaiser. We all know what Bandon Dunes and Cabot Links and Sand Valley and on and on. Number five, Peter Hill, who's the CEO of Philly Casper Golf. They are a very large golf business. They're in a lot of different stuff. Other names of interest, Kemper Sports administrators are in there, John Lesnick and Steve Skinner. PGA Executive Director, of course, Pete Bobakwa, Eric Anderson from Top Golf, Fred Ridley from Augusta is clear down to 21, Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour Commissioner, is number 10, Keith Kelly, number 11, Mike Davis from USGA 13, and Martin Slumbers from the RNA, number 14. The most influential people in golf are the heads of the five families, the PGA, the USGA, the RNA, the LPGA, and the Masters. These are the guys, along with the television executives, that decide how golf is presented on TV and what programs get funding. I would add that Steve Mona, executive director of the World Golf Foundation, is also among this group. He was well down the list of the top 30, but he actively works with the heads of the five families every day in his role. So not much goes on in golf that those guys don't give their approval to, Carlos. So a list of the top 30, I found it mildly amusing, and so I just thought I had to mention it.
Well, Back Niners, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report. Thank you for listening. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to our VIG, very important guest of the week, Ed Travis. Thank you for your great insight and your great participation on today's subject. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio. Or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or tune in. Or, as you can know, Roku TV as well. You can see it there. And if you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter or @BackNineReport, the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Fred Alvader. We wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Everybody needs to understand that I'm more than simply a hype man for this rap group. Just like GEICO is more than just a company that can save you money. GEICO also has fast and friendly claim service, so they can help you when you need it most. And while I do love being a hype man, I also love reading for children's audiobooks. Like Little Bo Peep, she lost her seat, and she don't know where to find them. Go!
GEICO. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.